What would they think of that? And just to also speak, we talk gender-based violence, but it's, like I said, doesn't just include women. Men are also affected by gender-based violence, men and boys. We can't get into a whole discussion about it right now, but those are also things that are going to be affected and probably cut across Canada. And just in Quebec alone, services that are specific and tailored for men experiencing gender-based violence, there's only about 3, maybe 4 in the whole province that are specifically tailored. So, for example, people can call SOS Violence Conjugale, there's Réseau Maison Oxygène, there's the support for sexually assaulted men in the Estrie region, the Centre de Ressources pour Hommes du Sud de la Naudière, and those are the only ones that are, you know, kind of covered by the government. The rest are sometimes community-based organizations just trying to do their best and trying to get grants and stuff. But this is what we need to consider.
And thank you for that story from our friends in Montreal. We're going to just adjust our program for today a little bit, as we're not going to have time for our story about the Northern BC traffic stop and some of the controversies about that. But we will bring you that story next week. We do have a story about harm reduction activities on campuses around BC. This is something all university campuses are looking into after the very unfortunate overdose death of a young student at the University of Victoria last year. And part of that death was caused by a lack of harm reduction preparedness on the part of the campus and their protocols, and I think all universities are looking at that. So this is a story from CHLY Radio at the University of the Fraser Valley about initiatives at that campus in Nanaimo.
This is a CHLY News update. As many new and returning students are settling into campus life at Vancouver Island University, the campus's Health and Wellness Center wants to educate students to make sure they know the impacts of the ongoing toxic drug crisis. Stephanie Begri and Chantelle Amistad are 2 fourth-year nursing students at Vancouver Island University. In their studies, they have been learning a lot about the toxic drug crisis and how it impacts the community in Nanaimo and at BIU.
This year alone, there's been 915 unregulated drug deaths, and out of all of those, 104 of them are between the ages of 19 to 29, so that's about the university age. So the more people we have trained here, I think the safer the community can be, and we could all make a difference in saving a life.
That was Amistad speaking about the deadly impacts the illicit drug supply has already had this year. Knowing the importance of education, Amistad and Bagri have started volunteering to offer a short-form version of naloxone training at school events through the VIU Health and Wellness Center. CHY met with them as they were offering the free training and education at the VIU Student Union's Back to School Frosh concert event held on campus Thursday night. Amistad says offering harm reduction on campus will teach students how to be more prepared in case of an overdose.
Harm reduction itself can seem like a very intimidating topic and overwhelming, and there's a lot of learning to do, and me myself, I'm just getting into the topic and learning about it, and I feel like it may not seem like you're doing a large part or learning a lot, but just engaging with the topic in itself and gaining that information is just helping destigmatize the topic overall.
Begri says that university students are at a very vulnerable age for substance use.
Substances, whether they're legal or illicit, substance use is going to happen. Especially with university students, they're entering new environments a lot of the times, meeting new friends, they're going to be more likely to be experimenting with things. So it's important for them to be able to know how to do use substances safely, and that comes along with knowing how to administer naloxone.
Begri says that while people cannot control whether or not other people will use drugs, people can still reduce harm and control how they react in the community.
I think, stigma acts as a big barrier to helping those who use substances. So I think getting to be more familiar with harm reduction can definitely help, you know, build like a stronger, more compassionate community.
As a registered nurse and harm reduction advocate, Sarah Lovegrove has seen firsthand how harm reduction can save lives. As a nursing professor at VIU, she says harm reduction training at a university or college is one of the most important spaces to offer the training.
In university, young people are experimenting and they're exploring who they are. And oftentimes that comes with engaging in altered states of consciousness, utilizing substances. And that goes far beyond alcohol.
She warns that in recent years, the toxic drug crisis has made all illicit drugs unpredictable in terms of its poignancy and content. She says that young people need to understand what they could potentially be getting into.
And so this is really starting their journey from a safety lens, from a place of understanding that risks are possible with this. And a lot of prohibition narratives around that really, you know, teach people that drugs are bad, don't do drugs. But then they leave home and they enter university and they start going to parties and realize that a lot of people are experimenting with substances, but they don't have the education between not using and potentially using for the first time what the risks really are in that.
Lovegrove co-created the VIU Harm Reduction Alliance at the university 3 years ago to create conversations around the toxic drug crisis and harm reduction. The Harm Reduction Alliance has been tabling at various back-to-school events this year, and Lovegrove says they have been hearing a lot from students. She says that while some students may not be ready to learn about harm reduction or take naloxone training, there are still some who get excited knowing this education is being offered on campus.
And then there's also some students who come with such enthusiasm and so much gratitude around this being offered on campus because they know their risks. They've lost friends, they've lost family, and they don't know how to obtain this training and these resources elsewhere.
Lovegrove says it's important for students who are using substances or may want to experiment with substances for the first time that more than ever, substances that are not directly from a pharmacy are likely to be contaminated and in need of testing.
Being aware is really important. And so taking a moment between being offered and taking and saying, what is in this? What do I know about this drug? What do I know about the source? Do I trust the source? And if the answer is I don't know or no to any of those questions, it's not a just say no situation, but it's also just an invitation to explore services.
Drug testing can be done at the Nanaimo Overdose Prevention Site at 250 Albert Street. As well, fentanyl testing strips can be found at the Campus Health and Wellness Center. Lovegrove highlights the story of 18-year-old Sydney McIntyre Starko, who died of an accidental fentanyl poisoning in her dorm at the University of Victoria in January 2024. Sydney's friends and family called on the university for what they say could have been a preventable death if Sydney or her friends had access to naloxone that night. An external review of that night found that the campus security, after arriving, waited 9 minutes to administer the life-saving naloxone and waited 12 minutes to start CPR. While in the past, the VIU Harm Reduction Alliance offered free naloxone training through Island Health for the campus, VIU has worked with the alliance to take on facilitating the training through its Health and Wellness Center. Naloxone kits can be found at the VIU Health and Wellness Center in Building 200 on the third floor. Nasal naloxone kits have been placed across the campus near defibrillators and the first aid kit in case of an on-campus overdose. The VIU Health and Wellness Center will offer a two-hour naloxone training for the VIU community on Friday, September 26th from noon to 2 p.m. in Building 210. Registration for the training can be found on their Eventbrite. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
Thanks to our friends at CHLY in Nanaimo for that report. Next up is Gardening with Embark. And then we're going to be back at about 10 minutes to the hour with
a bit about solar energy and what's the capacity in the future for energy to come from solar.
Great. Stay tuned for that. It's time now for Gardening with Embark. And joining us in the studio here, as he does every week, is Pablo Vimas. Thank you for being here, Pablo.
Nice to be here.
It's week
37.
Wow. Week 37.
Week 37 in our gardening calendar.
Yeah.
And Yeah, so as you notice, weather-wise, it's getting cold.
Mm-hmm.
We notice people wearing jackets, sweaters, hoodies.
Long sleeve shirts.
Yeah, long sleeves. Slowly, the shorts are being converted into long pants. And the garden as well is showing that.
Yeah.
In our garden here, the south of Maggie Benston, is having all the cabbages and kale have silver leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And as well, our beets are covered with a white powdery mildew.
Yeah.
So it really shows us that, yeah, we are moving into the fall, into fall. And that as well, we always gardeners are ahead of the weather, trying to be ahead for the season. And this time, as I will talk about Walla Walla onions.
Right.
So this is the time. Onions is a quite versatile crop.
Mm-hmm.
We can plant early in the spring or late in the fall. If we plant in the spring, there is the voila, the onions, they will grow over the summer, I mean, over the season, and in summer we'll be harvesting beautiful, delicious onions. But why not to plant early, late in the season?
Yeah.
So for overwintering.
Yeah.
So not all onions.
So when you're planting late, they get started, and then, but they won't be harvested until the spring?
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. Even beginning of summer.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact is that we don't want to keep our garden empty. So that is why we do overwintering. So always keep the garden busy, growing vegetables year-round. And vegetables like the Walla Walla onion is one of the vegetables that overwinters very well. So this is the time to start sowing using seeds.
Yeah.
So by week 44, I think, if I'm correct, the first frost will arrive. Mm-hmm. They are in a nice stage to overwinter. So it means that they are from a root system, a little bulb, and they just stand the weather in there.
Right.
And then when the spring comes, they will start developing because there is more light, and summer comes arrives, and we'll be able to harvest. If we plant Walla Walla onions in the spring, we have around 130 days to harvest. Right. Now we are going to plant late summer, early fall, and we have to wait 300 days to harvest. So that explains why we plant right now. So have a kickstart in the season, early spring. We say, oh, my onions are already doing well.
But doing it that way allows us to have a harvest in the spring.
Correct.
And then a second harvest later in the season.
Later in the season. Right. As well, we can use the leaves of the onions as chives, because you just create chop them and you can use them in the kitchen, and the leaves will continue growing. Something fascinating about Walla Walla onion is that it was developed in the Walla Walla Valley in Washington, the Pacific Northwest, so it's a crop adapted to our weather conditions. It can stand minus 23 degrees Celsius, okay, so it can stand frost. And so that makes them being a resisting crop for the overwintering, together with kale and cabbages and Brussels sprouts. So we have vegetables that we can grow over the winter.
That's good. And of course, like you say, it keeps you using the garden throughout, and opens up the opportunity for those relatively early sort of spring harvests.
Yeah, so as we develop our gardening skills over the years, we'd say, oh, I need to keep my garden busy over the winter. If you are just one season gardener, so now you will be thinking, oh, it's time to clean all my crops and cover the soil, protect the soil from the upcoming rains. Let's see how is the forecast for this weather in November. Usually it's very rainy. But as well, if you say, well, I'm one gardening season starting early March, and by now we are running out of energy. I have seen community gardens just left over for weeds to take over.
Right.
And unfortunately, weeds, they will flower. They will
spread seeds.
Spread seeds. And then you have a heavy, heavy early spring just weeding. So, so that is what I have noticed. There's one season gardeners. Some of them, they go all the season at the end of September, they will clean, they will protect the soil, or just leave the soil bare. But there are others like, gardening season is done, hands off. And they, nature itself tries always to protect it, protect itself. The soil always should be covered. So nature says, okay, there is nothing growing here, I will grow weeds.
Right.
And unfortunately, you will have a nice seed bank when you're returning in spring, and it will be always weeding, weeding.
So, I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is when people sort of, you know, as the weather cools and they sort of stop thinking about their garden until next year.
Correct, yeah.
You know, they're saving a little work now, but they're making themselves a whole bunch of work.
Correct.
Come springtime,
correct. Yeah,
right?
Because, the weeds will grow very quick. They are, I mean, little bit of sunlight and they are germinating and covering all.
Yeah, the and soil. I'm going to guess that the time you spend covering the garden and cleaning it a bit and just getting it ready for winter is probably a lot less than the amount of continuous works weeding you're going to need to do in the spring.
Yeah.
Not to mention all those weeds are going to be competing with what you're trying to grow.
Yeah, yes. As well as we've been talking about mulching, mm-hmm. laying a thick layer of leaves or cardboard or newspaper.
Yeah.
So that also creates a nice habitat for all living things mm-hmm. there in the soil. Because remember, November arrives, first frost, everything becomes cold, the soil gets cold, and the living creatures in the soil as well, they are looking for a space where to hide, where to overwinter.
Yeah.
So if we put a nice layer of mulch,
yeah.
all the living things will come up to the soil and
right.
the mulch, and they will stay in there all over winter. So,
mm-hmm.
so you know, what we want is to have a living soil,
yeah.
with lots of bacteria, fungi, and lots of invertebrates. So that's why we want mulch really. Helps to develop that.
Right, so people, if people aren't, planting a bunch of fall crops, or, they really do need to spend a little more time after their harvest, their summer harvest, just to get the garden ready.
Yep, get ready, protect it for the winter, and as well think all my living things in the soil needs protection
yeah.
too. Yeah.
And you'll thank yourself next spring when you can focus on the fun stuff
yep.
of putting
yep.
your seedlings in the ground and watching things grow and not fighting all the weeds that
yes.
that are dying yeah. to take over your plot.
Yes, that's right. And then all the fun of gardening is lost because now you're only focused on weeding, weeding, weeding. Well, we are. If you garden year round, you maintain the weeds low and continue feeding the soil,
mm-hmm.
continue using the garden. And so it's fun. You just keep doing fun things, and weeding
yep.
is at the back of your mind. It's
yep.
like, yeah, nothing to worry about.
If you do find yourself in that situation, is there any other solution besides just getting out there and weeding, weeding, weeding? Is there other ways to beat that? I'm sort of guessing that not if you want to grow plants and get rid of the weeds at the same time.
Yeah, so one of the things would be, yeah, because we have annual, all our vegetables are annual, so they need lots of sunlight
mm-hmm.
and space, and weeds will just come and compete for all the nutrients
yeah.
and sunlight and space and so on. So one of the crops that I always advise, if you don't want to make much work, you either start with a new land full of weeds, so suddenly your gardening was forgotten and there's lots of weeds,
yeah.
Potatoes. Potatoes
yeah.
is one crop that grows in the ground, and now and then you have to earth up the
yeah.
potato plant.
Yeah.
So by doing that process, you are kind of sideways weeding.
Right.
So early potatoes, which if you plant early in the season, by mid-May, you will have the first young
right.
fresh potatoes, and then you have the rest of the summer for growing all your
right.
other vegetables. Yeah.
Excellent. Always so much work in the garden, but also so much thinking and planning ahead.
Correct. Yeah. So now as well, this season, our workload is going down.
Yep.
Feel a bit more relaxed. So it gives us well time for recovering
mm-hmm.
And thinking what we have been well done, what went well, what didn't go well, what the mistakes we have done, and what we need to correct for next season.
Right. So, yeah, always thinking and always planning and having fun in the garden, hopefully, too.
Yeah, yeah. Having fun in the garden is the best because there are weeds to remove, but there are vegetables to harvest and taste, and there are flowers to pick,
mm-hmm.
and there are some edible flowers to pick, and herbs to smell and bring to the kitchen for flavoring the food.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Pablo. Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society, our weekly gardens expert. Tell us more about how people can find out more about Embark and your programs.
So Embark is a nonprofit organization based in Burnaby Mountain Campus, and we are an organization managed and directed by students for a student. So if you are ICFU student, you are already part of our organization. You can find further information of Embark through our website, embarksustainability.org, or through our social media channels at Embark Sustainability.
Great. Thank you so much, Pablo. Talk to you next week.
See you next week.
Some politicians love to tell us that we have to choose between policies that support people or policies that grow the economy. But we don't have to choose. A strong economy isn't only about stock markets and GDP. It's about all of us being able to afford our rent, our groceries, our medication. When we all thrive, the economy thrives too. Together, we can demand better. Take action at demandbettertoday.ca.
You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thanks for joining us this hour. Peter, you're going to talk about solar power.
Oh, yeah, sort of the what is it looks to be the future of it. Democracy Now! Last week had, they were sort of, how it's being blocked in the United States, solar power. But I kind of, one of the conservative talking points is that, well, solar power is only going to be a minority of the usage. You can't really bring it up under mm-hmm. any scenario. And then I guess the other side is that I kind of felt they didn't have their like they were just sort of saying, oh, well, it's just magic, just about. But here are some things to check up on it. This is from something. It's called International Intelligence Overview on Google. By 2050, some scenarios project. Oh my goodness. This is like, okay, just wait a minute. Why would this happen to me?
Just having some technical difficulties here.
The tablet. By 2050, some scenarios project solar to provide 30-40% of the U.S. electrical supply, or over 30% of global electric generations. Now, I don't know if that's a optimistic or whatever. It's kind of low in a way, because it's like, here some people talk and be 100% at some level. But here's something that I thought was interesting from a certain site. And they asked a question in the heading, when will 100% of electricity come from renewable energy, which is wind also and so on? Renewable energy will eventually generate 100% of the world demand. The truth is often forgotten, however. It is self-evident from the name alone. Non-renewable energy will run out, whether by supply, social, or economic pressure. So actually, that's an interesting concept. One thing is that what's sort of not talked about is that making that we're not consuming as much would mm-hmm. be maybe one thing to do also, because it just, even the more optimistic sort of screenios kind of don't see it being 100% for a while. So maybe we should be not consuming as much in general, because it just doesn't seem to be. How have you come across over the years of solar energy? And
well, I guess the first thing I was going to mention is, you know, I mean, in theory, it'd be nice if we could reduce the amount of energy we're using. But, you know, that's been one of the efforts of, you know, all the talk around climate change is one of the ways we should be doing this, and particularly when we still have a heavy reliance on fossil fuels, is to reduce the amount of energy we're using. But that seems to not be happening despite all the talk and efforts we're doing. So that's a challenging one. But from what I understand, a lot of the, you know, there is the developments in solar power itself and wind generated power, for example, which seem to be going really strongly. The other part of the equation is the development in battery technology. You know, with one of the things that's enabled, for instance, you know, the strong emergence of electrical vehicles, here in North America, but apparently really quite in a big way in other jurisdictions, has been the development of battery technology that allows the storage of a large amount of charge in a relatively compact package, and then the ability of fast charging and stuff. Well, that technology can also apply to renewable sources like wind and solar, because the biggest problem with one of the biggest problems with wind power or wind or solar power is they're dependent on the environment and what's happening in the environment. You can't generate a lot of solar power overnight, which is also a time when people are using a lot of electricity. They're turning all their lights on in their homes and stuff as the sun goes down, and then it's not generating. Wind, of course, is not always blowing, so it generates good when the wind is blowing, but so that's always been one of the issues with particularly solar and wind power. But when you combine that with advances in battery technology, so that, you know, your solar generators and your wind generators are feeding energy into batteries, so it's available when it's needed. Because, you know, I mean, one of the biggest and already very mature sources of renewable energy is water power, hydropower. Here in BC, we get a ton of our, I think, almost all of our power, not all of it, but most of it.
Worldwide, it's 6.7%.
Yeah. But here in BC, it's a huge proportion of it. And the thing that makes water power viable is that when you have a dam, you store water and then you can control the flow. Like if you just stuck a generator in the river, you'd get really wide seasonal variations in the amount of power generated, right? And it's that ability to store the power in the form of the kinetic energy of a large body of water behind a dam. You're basically storing that kinetic energy in containing that water, is what makes hydropower a really great and viable energy source. Well, the emergence or the introduction of the combination of new battery technologies along with the other with solar and wind energy starts making that more practical, because you can get energy when on demand and when you need it, not just when it can be generated. Well, that's one thing that's happening.
Okay, I'm going to do the pie chart. They got primary global energy consumption, 31.6% oil, 26% coal, 23% natural gas. And then we got 7.5 renewable, but that would include wind too, wouldn't
yeah.
it? 6.7 hydroelectric and nuclear, 4%. That's where it stands now. The other thing is, it's not just, we got what they say is climate change, but also it's that we're going to be running out of oil, of petroleum, and so on. That's the other thing. That's why that one site said, well, it's going to eventually be 100% renewable, because by the very word, it's not renewable energy that we're using. So, yeah.
I guess that, yeah, if, I mean, they're not counting nuclear energy in that equation.
Well, I did.
But in that 100%, because yeah. unless you define nuclear energy as a renewable resource. I mean, I don't, yeah.
Well, that's the other thing. I keep confusing fission and fusion. One is one or the other. One is what they're using now.
Yeah.
The other one is supposed to be cheap power forever. Have you heard of this?
Yeah,
which is which? To get it straight.
I believe, and I'm sorry, I wasn't ready for this.
I wasn't.
This factoid to be shared today, but I believe
it's one or the other.
I think it's fission we're using, which is the splitting apart of atoms
and releasing energy.
Fusion is when you're actually joining atoms together.
So fusion, they say, is impossible. But Arthur C. Clarke, the screenwriter of 2001: A Space Odyssey, was big on it. He died a few years ago, but some people.
I mean,
feel
there are
it's
people.
They,
yeah. I mean,
people
there are people
do.
Working on it, and I presume they believe it is possible. Although maybe it's a long shot, but presumably the benefits of cracking that particular problem will be immense. I mean, if it really offers the kind of nearly limitless energy production it offers. Well, that's how much time we have today, though, so we're going to end on that. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!, which is coming up in about 5 seconds. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Magnus Thiebold. Today is